ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, cars washed away, homes underwater, and locals forced to swim for their lives. Southeast Queensland hit by flash floods. Also, a shark attack in the heart of Sydney Harbour. Are warming seas bringing more predators to our waterways? And Channel 9 apologises after altering an image of a female politician to enlarge her breasts for the nightly news.
I think the fact that she's been treated this way is probably related to a portrayal of her as sexualised in a way that's really unfair to her current professional aspirations and focus.
First tonight, Queensland's unrelenting weather. Evacuation centres have opened and residents in parts of the southeast have started what could be a weeks-long clean-up after destructive flash flooding ripped through the areas north and west of Brisbane. Homes in one suburb had about a metre of water through them, with cars swept down the street. There have also been rescues from flooded cars and homes, and schools and businesses are closed, with authorities warning ex-tropical cyclone Kiralee's wet weather is now moving north. Stephanie Smale and Elizabeth Cramsey report.
Torrential rain has battered regional Queensland for weeks, but now it's the southeast turn, and the flooding that's followed has hit parts of the region hard. At Samford, west of Brisbane, Dennis Hanelt was forced to climb onto the roof of his car and stay there for about 5 hours.
You're sitting there and you think, if this comes much higher and this bloody truck moves, I'm had it. Because there was no way of getting out of it.
More than 300 millimetres of rain was recorded in the semi-rural community in a few hours, sending floodwater rushing through homes, businesses and across acreage.
When I stepped out of the van, I ended up in water over my knee deep. So in the end, I ended up sitting on top of the ute because I couldn't come up here because the water was rushing through there so much, so fast. Couldn't walk through it. Look, this is not looking good, you know. Because I was sitting there and the water was halfway up the side of the car.
He's not expecting the clean-up of his caravan or the house on the property to be quick.
The far side of the house is all wet. All the bedrooms, the laundry, bathrooms, all water coming through.
Locals have been pressure hosing and shoveling mud and debris at Samford all day, with the local bowling club and some cafes expecting a long recovery. Damien Effany has told reporter Elizabeth Cramsey about the damage to his rural supplies business.
Lots of hay, lots of bags of sugarcane and mulch, and even some gas bottles ended up in the little creek. So
you can sort of see faint lines around the store, just where sort of the water's come up to. What have you lost? What do you reckon?
The bottom couple of rows of every pallet, basically. So the water in the main part of the shop where we store horse feeds and chicken feeds, it's sort of come up on average probably around that 300 millimetres. So it's taken out the bottom two bags.
There's talk of more rain being on the way. Does that worry you at all, the forecast being still pretty wet for the next few days?
Yeah, I suppose there's that sort of fatalistic part which says that it's going to be what it's going to be, and the maths would say it won't be as bad as as it's been, or the probability suggests we won't see something like that.
At Bray Park, north of Brisbane, about a metre of water washed through some homes.
Oh, my God.
Although there had been heavy rain overnight, Hannah Waldock and her neighbours weren't expecting their street to flood so badly that some had to flee their homes.
We woke up to the water rising. It was about just up to like the wheels of all the cars on the front street. It was really scary, and about took like half an hour, and then it was through the house, about a metre up. My car is a write-off. It is totally damaged. We can't do anything about it, but I got insurance, so it'll be okay.
Businesses have been flooded at Laidley in the Lockyer Valley too. Kelly Makey says she had more warning before this flood than others, but it will take her the rest of the day to mop the mud out of her shop.
We got flooded February last year, May last year, and now this one. So I think there's many more to come. I just wish the council would do something with the gullies, clean it out, dig it out, or maybe have a pump system so the town does not suffer.
The flooding has cut roads and closed schools, and the risk isn't over yet. The Queensland Fire and Emergency Services Deputy Commissioner Kevin Walsh is warning the storms are still moving north and delivering heavy rain as they go.
Right across from Redcliffe up through Gympie, up to Bundaberg and out to Kingaroy. So there's a large area now that's in the firing line for this heavy downpour. And of course, because the ground is so saturated, the creeks are full, there's potential for some incidents this afternoon. So we're really encouraging everyone to stay aware of the surroundings.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has joined the Queensland Premier, Stephen Miles, for a briefing about the ongoing weather threat in Brisbane.
Stephanie Smale and Elizabeth Cramsey reporting there. Shark attacks are nothing new in this country. They're an unfortunate and occasionally tragic part of our coastal way of life. But the latest attack wasn't on some remote stretch of beach. It was right in the centre of Sydney, Elizabeth Bay, just a short stroll from King's Cross. Experts say warmer waters are drawing more bull sharks towards Sydney Harbour, and the aggressive predators are staying for longer. Here's reporter David Taylor, and a warning, this story contains some graphic content.
Just 2 kilometres from Sydney's CBD and moments from the famed King's Cross, Elizabeth Bay resident Lauren O'Neill swims from a private jetty to a nearby boat. A bull shark strikes on the way back. She makes it back to the jetty and climbs out of the water and manages a faint cry for help.
I got home from work and just sat down on the couch. I heard a sort of soft yell for help just outside the window.
Neighbour Michael Porter looks out the window
and saw Lauren propped up on the ladder external to the harbour pool trying to sort of climb in, and behind her was her leg, which was limp and all completely open, and a pool of dark red blood behind her straight away.
He grabs his phone and, running down to the water, dials 000.
My neighbour Simon was also outside on the seaside steps calling 000 as well. We went straight down to her side and just reassured her that everything was going to be okay. Within seconds, more neighbours started to come down with towels and wraps, and luckily Fiona, the vet, was there because she absolutely saved her life.
A chopper, paramedics and rescue teams are there within 15 minutes. Losing a lot of blood, Michael Porter and other neighbours now on the scene try and keep her conscious by asking questions. Lauren O'Neill had just bought an apartment in the building attached to the jetty. It's unclear why she was swimming, but her neighbour, Michael Porter, says he's been aware of the risks of shark attacks in the harbour.
And it's only now that it feels very real.
Former Navy clearance diver Paul De Gelder suffered serious injuries when he was attacked by a shark in February 2009. And nearby residents PM spoke to also seem aware of the risks of swimming in the harbour.
Well, you just have to use your common sense. I tried to, a few months ago, walk down the steps and slipped and got cut and bruised, and I said, that's it.
I would never swim at that time of night. Never.
And this fisherman, who's seen a few bull sharks in his time, wouldn't go near the water on Sydney Harbour.
Place is riddled with them.
The New South Wales government says Sydney Harbour is an important habitat for bull sharks. Over 87 of them, which can grow up to 3.5 metres in total length, have been tagged in the harbour since 2009. But right now in the harbour, the government's monitoring 18 of them. But let's get real for a moment. Are you likely to get bitten by a shark if you take a dip in Sydney Harbour today? Well, Amy Smoothie is a shark specialist with the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries.
We've learnt that bull sharks are a crepuscular species. They're more active in these low light periods, such as on dusk, throughout the evening and at dawn. Also, they're more numerous in our coastal waterways and on our coastal beaches in summer and autumn months, with January and February being their peak time of occurrence in our coastal waters.
Is there a greater chance of coming across a bull shark in Sydney Harbour over the next few weeks and months?
I wouldn't say that the encounter rate is any different from yesterday, from the next day.
So what can swimmers in waterways across the country do to reduce their risk of being attacked by a shark?
We know that there are times and conditions that may increase your risk, for example, after heavy rain or when it's murky.
Across the country, in February 2023, Stella Berry suffered injuries to her legs after being attacked by a shark in North Fremantle in WA. And last year, between May and December, there were three fatal shark attacks in South Australia. For those in New South Wales, there is more information available on the state government's Shark Smart app.
David Taylor. Edited images are no longer a surprise in celebrity gossip stories or even your own social media feeds, but a photo of a Victorian politician shown on Channel 9's TV news has led to a backlash. The image was digitally altered to enlarge MP Georgie Purcell's breasts and show off her midriff. Channel 9's apologised, but wait till you hear their excuse. Isabel Massali reports.
It's a photo Georgie Purcell knows well, taken about a year ago, just after her election to the Victorian Parliament. But when it resurfaced on Channel 9's TV News last night, the difference was obvious and alarming.
I immediately noticed that my stomach was exposed, but my whole stomach's tattooed, and it was bare. So I noticed that they turned my dress into a two-piece outfit, like a crop and a skirt, and have enlarged my boobs.
The Animal Justice Party MP says the edited image emerged during her toughest day on the job.
I think male MPs get to endure catastrophic days at work without having their bodies photoshopped or when they're on the nightly news. I just can't imagine this happening to a male politician. And I just wanted to point out the ongoing and, I guess, more insidious ways that female MPs continue to be treated.
Among those coming to her defence today was Premier Jacinta Allen, who was depicted nude in a newspaper cartoon last year.
That's no way to represent any woman, let alone a woman who holds a position in public office, represents a community, and is in the public discourse every single day. And also too, let's think about the message that sends, particularly to young women. Like, the distorted images that women see day after day, whether it's mostly on social media, you wouldn't want to see this happen often or at all, I should say, in mainstream media. We know that this is a contributing factor to anxiety and mental health challenges amongst young women and young men.
University of New South Wales law professor Rosalind Dixon runs the Pathway to Politics program, helping women with political ambitions to overcome barriers. She says while there's been progress in Australia, female politicians still face relentless focus on their image.
Georgie Purcell is a really interesting and out-of-the-mould politician who's got a background which, without her consent, was disclosed. When she was a law student, she also worked as a stripper, and that came out in ways that were very difficult for her. But she's copped a lot of flack and really taken it and continued to focus on the issues. But I think the fact that she's being treated this way is probably related to a portrayal of her as sexualised in a way that's really unfair to her current professional aspirations and focus.
In a statement, Nine News Melbourne director Hugh Nalan apologised to Georgie Purcell for the error.
Our graphics department sourced an online image of Georgie to use in our story on duck hunting. As is common practice, the image was resized to fit our specs. During that process, the automation by Photoshop created an image that was not consistent with the original. This did not meet the high editorial standards we have, and for that we apologise to Ms. Purcell unreservedly.
Professor Dixon says it's problematic if the image was created by a human, but she believes it's just as alarming if it was automated, because that shows a lack of human oversight. She then raises the recent circulation of a sexually explicit image of singer Taylor Swift generated by artificial intelligence. Professor Dixon says while it's different levels of depiction and different situations, both are demeaning and invades privacy.
I think it's really a sea change moment in media that, you know, you see Taylor Swift being sexualised and depicted through AI images. You see Georgie Purcell in the mainstream media facing something similar. Some people have said that 2024 in the United States is going to be the AI election. I think we see now that what's been online trolling and hate has now entered a new era of AI-enhanced sexualisation and, you know, the dangers for female public figures are really significant, and we need a human and a regulatory response.
One person who's raised issues with automation and AI images is Daniel Angus, but in this case he's questioning Channel 9's argument. He's a professor of digital communication at Queensland University of Technology.
There are no AI programs that I know of that would have created that likeness that Channel 9 have used. However, I do know of many ways in which these forms of broadcast choose to use processes themselves to accentuate certain kinds of body types or facial features or other things for editorial purposes. And so it's clear that I think that Channel 9 have made a deliberate choice to make those modifications. This is a poor judgment, editorial judgment on Channel 9's behalf, and they're scapegoating AI technologies and techniques to try and take the heat off what is a human error in this particular case.
Isabel Masali there. You're listening to PM with me, David Lipson. Coming up, one shielded a child with his body, the other carried a wounded soldier through gunfire to safety. The heroic acts of two Australian soldiers in Vietnam finally set to be recognised. The Middle East is now facing the most dangerous conditions since the Yom Kippur War 50 years ago, according to the US Secretary of State. America has vowed to retaliate after three US Army Reserve soldiers were killed and dozens injured in an Iran-backed drone attack in Jordan on Sunday. What that means isn't clear, but the risks of further escalation appear to be rapidly increasing. Rachel Mealy reports.
A word out of place could trigger a widening of the Middle East conflict. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, says the region is on the brink.
This is an incredibly volatile time in the Middle East. I would argue that we have not seen a situation as dangerous as the one we're facing now across the region since at least 1973, and arguably even before that. And that is the environment in which we're operating. And of course, that was triggered by the horrific attacks of October 7th by Hamas.
Secretary Blinken says the U.S. intends to respond to the attack on its personnel.
We will respond. We will respond strongly. We will respond at a time and place of our choosing.
But just what that response will look like remains unclear.
I'm not going to telegraph what we might do in this instance or get ahead of the president, but I can again tell you that, as the president said yesterday, we will respond. And that response could be multi-leveled, come in stages, and be sustained over time.
The three U.S. Army Reserve soldiers were killed in the drone attack on Sunday in a tiny outpost known as Tower 22, where the borders of Iraq, Syria and Jordan converge. The U.S. believes that Iranian-backed militias were behind the attack. Pentagon spokeswoman Sabrina Singh.
We know this is an IRGC-backed militia. It has the footprints of Kitab Hezbollah, but not making a final assessment on that. Our teams here are continuing to do the analysis, but we know that Iran is behind it. Iran continues to arm and equip these groups to launch these attacks.
Ben Scott is a senior advisor at the ANU National Security College. He believes assessments the region is on the verge of war are accurate.
We are close to the brink. We have been for a while. And I think Secretary Blinken's statement that I think to the effect that the region is in a more dangerous situation than it's been since 1973 and possibly earlier is probably true. That sounds about right to me. A lot depends on the messaging. Again, that's not easy. Of course, US and Iran don't have a direct diplomatic relationship. And there's just so much room for misunderstanding on both sides. Even when messages are sent with the best intentions and as transparently as possible, particularly on the Iranian side, the ability to misunderstand and misinterpret is pretty high. They have a very particular view of the world. So that's a challenge.
Ben Scott explains President Biden is likely considering a range of military options.
The low end, from hitting back at Iranian-backed militias in Iraq and Syria through to hitting as many Iranian personnel as they could in Iraq and Syria, scaling up to hitting Iranian-backed militias or Iranian personnel outside of those theatres, through to at the high end, actually hitting targets in Iran, which would be really high end.
Ben Scott there, he's a senior advisor at the ANU National Security College in Canberra. Rachel Mealy, our reporter. Well, for more, I spoke to Behnam Ben Taliblu, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defence Democracies, a think tank based in Washington, D.C.
The interesting thing is when you compare Biden to his predecessor, even though he has a softer policy towards the patron of these terror groups in the hopes of de-escalating and restoring the 2015 nuclear deal and engaging in restraint, he's actually used force more often against these groups. Former President Trump's red line or threshold for the use of force was the loss of American life. That hadn't happened on President Biden's watch up until now. So if force has been used, albeit very selectively and sporadically, the question is when the loss of life has occurred, isn't this administration required to do something even greater?
Well, what does that mean? What would a U.S. counterstrike look like?
Well, there's lots of discussion right now, particularly within the analytical community, about should at some point be the patron held directly accountable. However, there never has been any overt kinetic U.S. action on Iranian territory. And in fact, the one country to overtly strike Iran since the end of its last conventional war, the Iran-Iraq War, which ended in 1988, was actually Pakistan. So this would be very much akin to running a very dangerous social science experiment in real time. So much more likely you are going to see something again in the region that the U.S. lost life. So either in the Iraq-Syria land bridge, where Iran's militias have essentially laissez-passer, perhaps something could be continued in the cyber or covert realm. Perhaps the U.S. may respond in a different theater, perhaps moving up its military response against a different Iranian proxy, such as the one in Yemen.
Tell us more about why there's such a reluctance for the U.S. to go after Iran directly, even through non-kinetic means.
I think really the key word in your question there is non-kinetic means, and I really want to flesh that out for the audience, because there has been this trend in post-Cold War U.S. foreign policy politics where one U.S. president, rather than building on the successor or the predecessor, I should say, ends up actually for political reasons looking to do a 180. You know, nowhere has that been more sharp than President Obama compared to President Bush, and then President Trump compared to President Obama, and then currently now President Biden compared to President Trump. President Trump left the 2015 nuclear deal that the Barack Obama administration was able to achieve with Iran in the P5+1, and now President Biden, who was Obama's vice president, has been for over 2+ years now not actively enforcing older, particularly oil-related sanctions, in the bids of resurrecting this deal and trying to restrain Iran's nuclear program and trying to undo what the former President Trump administration called the maximum pressure campaign. However, and most ironically, in the face of this restraint, the Islamic Republic's nuclear program has grown immensely. Mm-hmm. Its ballistic missile and drone program has grown quite significantly. Its risk tolerance to warm up ties with America's great power competitors, be they China economically or Russia politically and militarily, as we see with the provision of drones to Ukraine and the likely impending sale of ballistic missiles to Russia for use against Ukraine, means that the Islamic Republic is more confident taking risks when it sees an adversary like Washington backpedaling. And that desire for a deal has been, unfortunately, in my view, been able to be strategically dangled by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And the administration now finds itself in the very precocious situation that it is.
Is that confidence that you talk of what's behind Iran's attempt to, you know, provoke the U.S. in this way? What's in it for Iran to do this?
Well, I certainly think Iran, or I should say the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran, because you've had a wholesale rebuke of Iranian foreign and security policy by the population. You know, one need only think of the protests in 2009 that had chanted, "Not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran." And that chant has featured in various iterations of national anti-regime protests from 2017 to present. And then, you know, particularly foreign policy critiques featured from 2018 and then 2022 in the aftermath of the killing of Mahsa Amini. But nonetheless, what the regime feels is that, you know, when it has faced a challenge at home, it needs to look strong abroad, particularly challenge in the face of those protests. That's one angle. The other is the more capable it is, meaning the more confident it is in the capability of its military systems, particularly those ballistic missiles and drones. Let's not forget that for almost a decade and a half now, different American directors of national intelligence under Republican and Democratic administrations have attested that Iran is home to the largest ballistic missile arsenal arsenal in the Middle East. In 2022, for example, that arsenal killed for the first time ever a U.S. citizen in northern Iraq. To date, the U.S. has not kinetically responded to that. So in the face of this restraint politically due to the administration's desire to beget a new deal or restore that older nuclear deal, in the face of an evolution in the long-range strike technology the regime has, in the face of brutally repressing different rounds of anti-regime protests, the regime actually, in the aggregate, feels comfortable flexing its muscles abroad.
That's Ben Taliblu from the Foundation for Defence Democracies. The heroic acts of two Australian soldiers who died together in Vietnam in 1965 are finally set to be recognised. Their bravery to save a Vietnamese child and a wounded soldier prompted recognition from the United States, but for decades the Australian government refused to acknowledge it. Samantha Donovan reports.
In May 1965, the battalion of Australian National Serviceman Kevin Wheatley was under fire in Vietnam and took cover. A Vietnamese woman and her children were sheltering nearby, and a little girl, estimated to be about 3 years old, ran towards the road screaming. Warrant Officer Wheatley ran out to save the child, shielding her from the gunfire with his body and saving her life. Months later, on November the 13th, 1965, Kevin Wheatley, known as Dasher, would die of gunshot wounds beside his comrade, Warrant Officer Ron Swanton. Swanton had carried a wounded Vietnamese soldier across an open paddy field while under enemy fire before being wounded himself. Now, nearly 60 years after those acts of heroism, Australia's Defence Honours and Awards Appeal Tribunal has recommended that earlier decisions be reversed and both men be awarded posthumously with the Medal of Gallantry. Ray James is an immediate past president of the New South Wales RSL and a friend of the Wheatley family.
Well, it's always good to see when veterans are recognised for their bravery and their service to the country. So I know the family would be ecstatic over this, to finally be acknowledged for what he did, and he did it fighting for his country.
Professor Ben Wadham is an ex-serviceman and the director of Open Door at Flinders University, an organisation that supports defence personnel and their families. He's pleased to hear that Kevin Wheatley and Ron Swanton have been recommended for the Medal of Gallantry.
Yeah, I think it's a positive move. I think it's important that the tribunal continues to review these different cases, both that have been awarded and those that haven't been awarded.
Do you think there are still a lot of acts of gallantry or heroism performed in Vietnam that haven't been recognised appropriately?
I do think that, and I think my own experience of that comes from my connection to the Vietnam veteran community, but also to the more contemporary community. There are cases across history where different groups and different theatres of conflict or different operations or exercises are not recognised.
I know that Lieutenant Colonel Harry Smith, who died last year, he was the commander at Long Tan. He had a long fight to get his men recognised with appropriate awards. Is it the junior soldiers, those who don't have a rank, who often miss out?
I think that's generally true, particularly in the case of Vietnam, when the system tended to award medals to the commanders who were there, but not necessarily who conducted the acts of gallantry. So I think in that case, definitely there would be a whole community of Vietnam veterans who understand that they may not have received the sort of recognition that they deserved.
We know that the Vietnam veterans faced a very difficult time on returning home. They were often ostracised. Did the fact many of them didn't receive appropriate medals and recognition add salt to those wounds?
You know, in more recent terms, we've moved away from just the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder to the concept of moral injury. And the fact that this was considered to be an unjust war, and this was a war where the soldiers themselves were targeted by the civilian population, is one extra burden that Vietnam veterans have to carry. But I think also that the way in which medals are given is another burden, because it meant that commanders and those with rank were recognised more easily than those who were actually probably more in the thick of it.
While Kevin Dasher Wheatley may now be awarded the Medal of Gallantry, along with his mate Ron Swanton, it's not his highest honour. Mr Wheatley was posthumously awarded the Victoria Cross in 1967 for refusing to leave a dying Swanton. They died together.
Samantha Donovan there. That's the program for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, have a good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Just before Christmas, journalist Antoinette Latouf was filling in on ABC Radio in Sydney when 3 days into a 5-day contract, she was told, don't come back. She's now accusing the ABC of unlawful dismissal. So what happens when social media collides with the workplace? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.